if they start busting through the boundaries of the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act with Iraqi oil, I want to be able to take them to court about it.
And a better name for that energy bill would be the Nuclear Power Relapse Bill, because it's calling for the construction of new nuclear reactors in the United States for the first time in 30 years.
They want to make this government Christian. They want to make all governments Christian. I think they believe when we achieve that, then Christ himself can return.
The Americans have unfortunately developed the capacity to dominate all decisions on earth, air, the seas, and space.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Friday, August 8th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. President Bush claimed major progress in Iraq today, but mourned the growing loss of American lives 100 days after he declared an end to major combat. Bush also edged into California's turbulent recall campaign, saying that movie actor Arnold Schwarzenegger would make a good governor. White House officials had taken pains to stress that Bush will stay out of the recall campaign against Democratic Governor Gray Davis, and Bush asserted that, quote, the people of California will sort all this out, unquote. Iraqi insurgents killed two U.S. soldiers and wounded at least seven others in a series of attacks late Wednesday and yesterday, dashing hopes that 2 days of relative calm would continue. Nevertheless, L. Paul Bremer, the U.S. civilian administrator for Iraq, predicted yesterday that general elections could be held within a year to form a government to replace the U.S.-appointed governing council, which was announced 2 weeks ago. Many Iraqis questioned the council's legitimacy because Bremer appointed its members, and many of whom are former exiles, and because he maintains veto control over its decisions. Killing an American may now be worth $5,000 to an Iraqi in Saddam Hussein's heartland, a large increase of the bounty that the U.S. commander in the region said is a sign of desperation among guerrilla diehards. The word is the price has quadrupled from doing attacks on U.S. forces, Major General Ray Odinero told a news conference at his headquarters here in Saddam's hometown. Rates some weeks ago were about $250 for an attack and $1,000 for a successful one, he said, adding that we believe now that's gone to about $1,000 and $5,000, something in that area. President Bush signed Executive Order 13303 on May 22, 2003, which created broad immunity for Iraqi oil. A recent article in the counterpunch.org website suggested that this executive order was signed by Bush to implement UN Resolution 1483, which ended sanctions against Iraq and created a development fund for Iraq. Peace Watch spoke with the legal director to the Government Accountability Project, Thomas Devine, about exactly what Executive Order 13303 is.
There seems to be a gap between what it says and what the administration claims it meant. But let's start with what it says. As written, the executive order appears to cancel the rule of law for the oil industry or anyone else who gets possession or control, whether legally or illegally, of Iraqi oil or anything of value related to Iraqi oil. And that's from extraction until we finish making money off it back here in the States.
So there's an exemption?
This would be a cancellation of liability. What the executive order literally does is cancels the judicial process with respect to Iraqi oil or products or anything of value that's related to that, even advertising. And it says that any judicial orders that would be issued about that are null and void.
And so that's what it says.
That's what it says. And what it says basically is that we're operating under a system of corporate anarchy for anything that's related to Iraqi oil.
Mm-hmm. And so you say that there's a difference, there's a discrepancy between what it actually says and between what the Bush administration claims that it says.
Yes, the administration claims that this was actually an initiative to help the Iraqis and preserve their capacity to make money in rebuilding their country without getting any collateral, any side attacks from the U.S. legal system. But, boy, if that were the case, wouldn't have been hard to say that. And I don't know why the administration hasn't been actively taking credit for this humanitarian initiative. They really don't have that much to brag about in terms of helping the Iraqi people. And if they're really sincere about helping the Iraqi people, then I think they would want to shield laws like the Alien Tort Claims Act that preserve liability if our companies engage in slave labor or sexual harassment or other human rights violations against the Iraqi people. But boy, you look and look and look, and there's just not any words like that.
Well, Jim Vallette and Steve Kresman wrote an article on the counterpunch.org website recently, and it suggested that this executive order was signed by Bush to implement UN Resolution 1483, which ended sanctions against Iraq and created a development fund for Iraq. Can you explain what the development fund is and what specifically does UN Resolution 1483 say about Iraqi's oil?
It's the more credible version of what the Bush administration is doing. It's an internationally financed fund, including our money and money from the World Bank, that would be helping to redevelop Iraq through resuming the commerce in oil. And there's some real questions about that, whether it's creating too much of a blank check that could be a camouflage for misconduct. But it's much more balanced. I don't think we'd have such a gripe if the executive order were implementing the Security Council resolution, but its text actually violates it. And I'll give you some examples.
Mm-hmm.
The Security Council resolution creates immunity for only a very limited time until title for the oil passes to the first purchaser. It keeps commerce from being paralyzed in case there was something which was going to be freezing the assets and stopping sales of oil from occurring. Well, that's not the case with the Bush executive order. That's a blanket of immunity for the oil companies as long as they're making money off the oil. There's no end to it. A second example is that the UN resolution specifically says that there isn't going to be any liability shield for ecological accidents like oil spills, so that if there were something else like the Valdez oil spill, people could still sue for the damages. That's just not in the Bush executive order. Blanket immunity. Another difference between them is that the UN order ends at the end of 2007. The Bush executive order can create this immunity for the oil industry forever, as far as it's written. Now, the government claims that they didn't mean this and that it'll all be cleared up in their regulations, but they haven't said when the regulations will be issued. And for the meantime, we're operating under a premise of corporate anarchy, at least as far as the language of the law is concerned.
Well, if the Bush administration contends or admits that they didn't intend to write this executive order or issue it in just this way, why not just rewrite another executive order and do away with that one?
Well, that's the question that some of us were asking the Treasury Department just yesterday. And we'd like to continue the discussions and try to help them just correct a mistake if that's the case, but they don't seem interested in continuing the dialogue. They've said there's really no problem, and it's unnecessary to do anything else except they'll be issuing some regulations, and we should wait, and we'll be happy when we read them.
Is this the first time an order issuing this kind of wide scale across the board blanket immunity to a corporation or has been issued by the executive branch, or are there other examples of this?
Some of the constitutional law scholars reviewing this have said that it's unprecedented, but the order was issued under economic emergency law, which grants the president the authority to sweep aside Congress in the normal legislative process or even potentially cancel judicial process. And that raises the real question here. Where's the fire? What was the emergency that forced the Bush administration to bypass Congress in issuing an order that canceled the judicial system for commerce related to Iraqi oil?
Well, they would probably argue the war.
It was issued on May 22nd. We'd already won the war.
Okay. We'd already won the war, so what was the emergency?
That's the multi-billion dollar question.
You're quoted as saying that this executive order cancels the concept of corporate accountability and abandons the rule of law. Which specific laws does this violate, in your opinion?
Well, we're not going to have access to the judicial process for anything connected with activities related to Iraqi oil or oil products. So just start thinking, occupational safety violations for workers who are involved in extracting the oil or marketing it, EEO violations, employment laws ranging from child labor to minimum wage. There's nothing that puts a border on where the immunity ends geographically, so it can extend to the United States, and it specifically protects marketing, so false advertising about the Iraqi oil. The Federal Trade Commission couldn't go at it. How about environmental laws? If we're going to be getting gas at the pump that doesn't comply with the pollution laws, is that going to be okay because the gas came from Iraq? And if that's the case, and I were an oil company, I'd make sure that every drop of oil that I sold was a mixture of Iraqi oil and domestic, because don't have to worry about the legal system. The one that really raises questions is last year's landmark corporate accountability reform, the Sarbanes-Oxley law, which had accounting standards to protect shareholders. Are companies that make money from Iraqi oil going to have to account to their shareholders what happens to that money? And for us at the Government Accountability Project, a whistleblower support group, probably the most serious consequence would be canceling the landmark whistleblower protection law in the Sarbanes-Oxley reform that creates corporate freedom of speech for workers challenging misconduct by big business. Are they going to be stripped of their free speech rights now and effectively muzzled or gagged? The administration has a lot of explaining to do how the executive order preserves all these basic statutes that keep our society functional. They say they didn't mean to cancel them, but it would sure be helpful if they would point to some language, any language, in the executive order that says they still exist for the oil industry. The executive order says that any actions through the judicial process are prohibited and shall be deemed null and void. And that's with respect to the development fund, Iraqi oil or products, any interest, financial consequences of any nature whatsoever. I'm reading that from the order. Any nature whatsoever arising from or related to the sale or marketing of any Iraqi oil or petroleum products that, quote, come within the possession or control of United States persons. And that's defined as corporations.
What are the chances that Congress, the American people, the lobbyists can actually craft some regulations that would stem or alter this or amend this dramatically to the point where it's more of interest and beholding to the American people and the rights of the American people?
Where there's a question whether regulations can cancel the language of an executive order or whether it has to be rescinded, has to be pulled back and reissued. If I were a corporate lawyer worth my salt and the government wanted to take some action against me, I just don't see how it would be possible to resist telling the court that they don't have any authority. Listen to the President of the United States, and it really doesn't matter too much which subsidiary regulations affect the government's actions. The jury's out on that one. But Congress does have the power to act. A joint resolution can overturn or overcome an executive order. And right now, the challenge is to get this on the congressional radar screen. From everything we can tell, the administration blindsided Congress when they issued this order. We haven't found any legislator who's willing to stand up and say, I knew about this and thought it was all right. And once they're up to speed about what's been done behind their backs, we think there's a lot of legislators who want to defend the rule of law in this country.
Well, from your explanation of this executive order, it seems as though it would likely be of far more benefit to foreign businessmen and corporations and the people of Iraq themselves. Just how is this being justified by the Bush administration, and how are they reasoning that such an order is necessary?
Well, their reasoning is that there could be pre-existing legal disputes or claims or things which would be attaching to the Iraqi oil. It's like when you buy a house and somebody has a claim to the title of it, and you have to get that clear before you're really free to buy the house. And they're saying something like that could be blocking or paralyzing trade in Iraqi oil and stopping the country from getting back on its feet. And that's fair enough. And now all they have to do is write an executive order that reflects that purpose instead of one that erases all of the ground rules for legal accountability.
And finally, Tom Devine, why should Americans be concerned about this executive order?
Well, part of the reason is that our government sold us this war on grounds that it was going to be defending the rule of law in Iraq and restoring rule of natural law and respect for human rights principles. It's really kind of an insult to us as citizens if, having won the war, we cancel the rule of law in that nation and exempt big business from liability under human rights laws. The second reason is there isn't anything in the executive order that restricts corporate immunity to activities taking place in Iraq. The Iraqi oil starts contaminating our society through pollution or through any sort of illegality that can't coexist in a civil society, inhumane activities that are related to commerce in Iraqi oil back here at home. That's going to backfire directly on the American people. And I'll tell you, if they start busting through the boundaries of the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and everything else with Iraqi oil, I want to be able to take them to court about it.
And so what is the Office of Government Accountability, that project? What are you doing at this point to try and reel this in?
Well, we're teaming up right now with two other organizations, Sustainable Energy and Economy Network at the Institute for Policy Studies. They're sort of the heroes. Their researcher, Jim Vallette, discovered the executive order and started recruiting reinforcements. And Earth Rights International, which leads the work in human rights suits under the Alien Torts Claims Act. And we're preparing a list of hard questions that we think the Treasury Department has to answer if their excuses that they're just misunderstood are going to pass the laugh test. If the Treasury Department doesn't answer these questions, we're very confident that a lot of offices in Congress are going to demand them. And once the facts come out about what the administration has gotten us into and what they're willing to do to fix it, then we think that it's quite likely that Congress will fill the gap and restore some sort of civilized ground rules for trade in Iraqi oil.
Any final thoughts on your part, Tom Devine?
Yes, we have a real basic question. How did this happen? Why is it that the Bush administration thought that it could issue something with such drastic implications for society without doing their homework? Even if they thought that it was viable to blindside Congress, at least you think they would have checked the language of what they were up to, and somebody would have said that we're not saying what we mean. It's a very smart group of people, and right now it's flunking the credibility test that they didn't know what they were writing.
What does this say about Congress at this point?
It says that Congress was out of the loop on something which could backfire and have horrible consequences for our country, both internationally and at home. And it says that Congress has some real catching up to do.
Tom Michael Devine, Government Accountability Project Legal Director. The language used by the White House to justify its foreign and domestic policy these days is increasingly religious. Many Americans deplore what they see as the dangerous mix of religion and politics in the Middle East. The difference, as conventional wisdom has it, between them and us is that they are fundamentalists and capable of religious democracy. A recent article by Jeffrey Charlotte in Harper's Magazine raises some serious questions about how comfortable we ought to be with our own mix of religion and politics, and just how grounded in reality our assumption of separation of church and state really is. Charlotte went to live last year with a group of U.S. congressmen, senators, and businessmen who belong to a little-known organization called The Family. That group is organized around using their political power to serve Jesus. But as Charlotte found out, it often sounds a lot more like Jesus serving political power. He spoke with Farah Charmchi of Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston.
They've been hiding in plain sight for so long. They're right there. They're in Arlington, which is right across the river from Washington, D.C. You can go there and become a brother, spend some time and deepen your relationship with Jesus and go back to ordinary life, and that's the extent of it. Or you might go there and get mentored by a senator. Then when you leave, go to work for that senator, then be launched into a political career. The group is not interested in being as big as it can, and it will turn away people who'd like to be involved. It's more interested and bringing together a network of elites, of guys, men and women, in power, in business, the military, and government. Those are the three areas that they focus on.
Could you talk about whether you feel like the members of this group use the power that they attain through their political connections to, in fact, gain wealth?
The core group does not do it for their financial gain, and I think that's a really important point because a lot of people look at this and see it as a cynical exercise. The main guys involved are not particularly wealthy. I think they believe in Jesus. They are true believers, and if you want to argue with them, you argue with them theologically instead of just saying, oh, you're a phony. That said, it really is a theological view of the world in which the world should be completely ruled by Christian theocracy.
So as far as you could see, the motive for most of these men for participating in the organization is just their heartfelt religious beliefs, and this is a way of expressing that?
Many, many of the people involved get involved with very good hearts. Many of them really do care, are people who have seen suffering in the world and want to do something about it, but they get involved with this group that kind of channels all their efforts toward acquiring power for a particular worldview and doing so through maintaining power as it is. They're not really interested in branching off and building, you know, some new Christian government. They want to make this government Christian. They want to make all governments Christian. Their goal for the future, stated in their documents, is an international network of 200 world leaders united by their total bond to Christ. I think they believe when we achieve that, then Christ himself can return.
So could you talk a little bit more about their particular theology?
They've always identified Jesus with a certain kind of fairly laissez-faire capitalism. One thing they knew Jesus didn't want was communism, but it wasn't so much a negative as against communism. They really felt that Jesus wanted to give every man the right to succeed. And you might also interpret that as to give big corporations the right to make a lot of money. And they've always had a lot of corporate allies. Raytheon in the 50s and 60s fighting communism. Standard Oil, when it existed, was virtually a department of this group. They would use Standard Oil's offices in various countries as their local headquarters. And they've always thought that these corporations it's a good model for what God wants for the world, because they see it, well, as a strong-willed man is going to rise to the top of the corporation, and he's going to make the decisions for the rest of us. Their way of interpreting Christianity is they say, well, look, remember, the cross is vertical, not horizontal. The power is given down vertically through a hierarchy.
So if you had to summarize, who do they want in their group? What's the basis of their decision for including people? How would you state that?
It's pretty simple. Power. I think in their documents, they would say, look, we're interested in anyone. But if you look at the history of the group and the people they've included, it's always been the powerful. And they are willing to deal with people, for instance, who don't necessarily conform to the right-wing view of the world. These strong men around the world have friends in American government, and that's just going to give them the edge when it comes to, well, should we cut off military aid to this individual? General Suharto in Indonesia killed 500,000 people. When I spoke to one associate of the group, His defense of this was that, well, maybe he would have killed 1 million people if we hadn't made friends with him. The idea of saying, well, maybe instead of bringing Suharto in for a smooth landing, maybe there is an imperative for Christians, because they are Christians, believers in Christ, to speak truth to power, to oppose these guys who are killers. But that's not how they see it. It's rather work with power wherever they can. And there's very few bad guys around the world they felt they couldn't work with. In South America and Central America, they virtually made a specialty of seeking out the death squad leaders.
There's a use of religious cliche, a certain set of phrases that just gets repeated. And it strongly resembles not the casual banter you'd expect to hear among friends or people that spend a lot of time together, but actually corporate language. Can you talk a little bit about that?
There's a certain amount of emphasis on buzzwords. They can be repeated, and it becomes a private language, because if you're initiated into it, you know the different ways the word is used. Now, one word they would use, for instance, is always heart. You can have a heart for the poor, or a heart for God's workers, or a heart, if you have a heart for missions, a heart for this. And it seems like that's not a very complicated use of the word, not a very subtle way of expressing all the different callings that an individual might have in life. But within the fold, I think they do understand those nuances. And the same with, for instance, the word love. They repeat the word love endlessly, and this is, of course, true of most religions. And I think it's important for non-believers to pay attention to the different ways in which love is used. So, for instance, I was explicitly told at one point, love is, you know, it's not just me caring for you and you caring for me. Love is also, for instance, the Jesus depicted in the Gospel of Matthew, who comes not bringing peace but the sword. The Jesus who promises he's going to separate father from son and mother from daughter. That was quoted at me explicitly when I told the group that I wanted to leave, that I had to go attend to some family matters, which was true. And they said, no, you've got to remember this, that love doesn't necessarily mean paying attention to your family. Sometimes you have to hate your family in order to love Jesus.
What do you think the implications are then for those outside the fold who aren't paying attention to this religious language or are dismissing it as just being irrelevant?
So many religious groups, so many fundamentalist groups often get a free pass from the rest of society. We don't pay close attention to the language. I think a part of that is a certain amount of disrespect for religious people, that we don't take them seriously. One of the insights of the founder of this group and all the men who followed that differentiates them from the Jerry Falwells and the Pat Robertsons is that they realize that there's really no percentage in wasting, you know, it's the old kindergarten rule. You don't have anything nice to say about anyone. Don't say anything at all. Well, they'll just keep talking about love. And it makes them, as a group, very hard to attack. How can you complain about someone who's just said they just want to love and they just believe in reconciliation? At the same time, it's always in this context of being around mostly other upper-class young men and being around people in power, senators. Heads of state would come to visit, prominent businessmen. And it gives you this idea that what Jesus wants is the way the power is, Jesus wants that to continue. Jesus believes in the status quo. Jesus believes that if you are in power, it's because he's chosen you to be in power. And that's one of their core beliefs, is that they see themselves as a new chosen.
Divine right of kings.
Yes, exactly. And they would say that. They would say so. They say, remember, you know, Christ's kingdom is not a democracy. Jesus is the king. And that's our model for the world.
Jeffrey Charlotte of Harper's Magazine, who went to live last year with a group of U.S. congressmen, senators, and businessmen who belong to a little-known organization called The Family, a group that is organized around using their political power to serve Jesus. He was speaking with Farah Charmchi of Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston.
Hi, I'm Lona Elias, the editor of Peace Watch. If you are enjoying this show, let me invite you to take a moment and make a donation to ensure that Peace Watch continues. You can make a secure online pledge of support by visiting our website at www.pacifica.org. That's www.pacifica.org. Or send us a check or money order to Peace Watch, 2390 Champlain Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. That's Peace Watch at 2390 Champlain Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We need your support, for it is your support that makes Peace Watch possible. Thank you.
We'll be back in a moment.